In a sense, today's podcast is all about leadership. I'm a diehard believer in pace of the leader, pace of the team. And the one quality that all true leaders possess, the quality that sets them apart from others, is they inspire you. When you're around a great leader, you want to be around a great leader. You enjoy spending time with them, you learn from them, and in many cases, by just spending time with them, you too can become a great leader. Excuse me. Our guest today is a great leader at a time when the world is hungry for great leadership, especially when it comes to leadership in the green or sustainability space. You'll want to stay with me to hear why this man and his organization inspires all those whose lives they touch. Hi, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth. I'm honored to have as our guest today Joel McCower. He is the chairman and executive director of Green Biz Group, creator of greenbiz.com, along with research and events on sustainable business and clean technology. He hosts Green Biz's annual Green Biz forums, as well as The Verge and Circularity conferences produced by his company, and it is principal author of the annual State of Green Business, which is going to blow all of your minds. And I want to just reemphasize, stay with me. For 30 years, Joel has been a well-respected voice on business, sustainability, and clean technology. As a writer, speaker, and entrepreneur on corporate sustainability practices, he has helped a wide range of companies align environmental goals with business strategy. In fact, I love this one, Joel. The AP called him the guru of green business practices, and I could not agree more. So welcome, my friend. And, you know, I write those write-ups up, and I have to, you know, honor all you've done. And it just, it sounds rote, but I try to emphasize every word because you have accomplished a lot with a magnificent group of people. So thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, Gina. You're very kind. Thank you so much for that. And it's a pleasure to be talking again. There's a lot going on.
Oh my gosh. And the report, there were some shockers in there for me. But I know we could pull off a two-hour show in a heartbeat and keep people interested. But I think if you just give a brief overview of Green Biz, it kind of helps set the stage for what we're talking about in terms of the report.
So Green Biz, the company, is a media and events company. We publish newsletters every day. We have three big events every year. And it's all focusing at the intersection of companies, big companies, sustainability and innovation, and including increasingly risk. We have a news media side. We have an event side. We also have a membership group of sustainability executives from some of the world's biggest companies, about 90 of them that we bring together several times a year face-to-face for what we call peer-to-peer learning, and they often call group therapy. But it's a great, terrific bunch of people, and gives us a chance to really hear firsthand how and what companies are doing, the kinds of progress they're making, the kinds of challenges, barriers, and frustrations they're encountering. And so this report that we do, the State of Green Business Report. This is our 13th annual. A number of years ago, back in 2007, I guess, when we did this, the first one was launched in early 2008. You know, we were saying we've been covering this stuff every business day for, at that point, about 10 years, and I've really been doing this personally longer than that. And there's lots of great stories. It's always very encouraging and exciting to see what companies are doing, but is it enough? And is it making a difference? Is it moving the needle? Basically, how are we doing? And so that's what we set out to do every year, both through metrics and partnerships with our colleagues at Trucost, part of Standard & Poor's S&P Global, and by naming 10 trends for the year or two ahead that we think sustainability professionals in companies and outside of companies should be following.
And when I read it, I started making a list of people that I want to send it to who are business partners of Mrs. Green's World, like our local utility company, like a complex of buildings that are going to, they want to be zero waste in an industry that is almost impossible. So I made a list of about 15 people. My brother is a wealth manager, And he is not in the business of sustainability, but he wants to know where markets are going, where big companies like Unilever and Amazon and Nestle, where they're going. So I'm going to be doing my own little PR campaign. As I think it's a gift that you give to business leaders, whether they're big or small, because it will have an impact on all businesses. That's how I felt after I read the report. So let's dive in. And what I really think we should do is just go one by one. There are 10. If I have time to fit in a question for each one, I have at least 4 questions for each one. So let's get it done, because I would like you to talk about it. There were some big surprises in there for me, maybe not for you, but let's go. What's number one?
So you're talking about the 10 trends that
yes.
we name each year. And that's the first half of the report. The second half is about 30 different metrics that look at how the companies around the world are doing in terms of making progress or not. But the trends are interesting because we've been doing, as I said, this is our 13th report, which means naming 10 trends each year that we've now named about 130 trends. And, they're sort of looking out a year to 2 years in horizon in terms of what we'll be seeing coming. And I have to say, we have a decent track record in terms of looking at things. Sometimes, 2 or 3 or 4 years out before, like the circular economy 5 years ago, that's now quite the thing. The rise of environmental, social, and governance, ESG reporting by companies for mainstream investors several years ago, that's really a thing now. And so we don't hit them all, not by a long shot, but it's some good indicators here. So the first one of the 10 trends for 2020 is about the decarbonization of shipping, specifically big cargo ships, and what they're doing to, because they are still one of the remaining sectors that haven't really been tackled appropriately and haven't really taken the necessary efforts. And with the rise of globalization, the shipping continues to grow. The number of big container ships going across the Pacific and in some cases the Atlantic continues to be significant. 50,000 vessel, tanker, freighter, and cargo ship fleets that float trillions of dollars of goods every year. And they're also very polluting. Ships use traditionally use a low level in terms of purity of petroleum called bunker fuel, and it's very polluting. So this is a big part of what we need to be doing. It's not just cars and homes and factories. It's airplanes, airlines, and ships. And so there's a lot going on. There's this recognition that this is an important thing. And some of the big global shipping companies like Maersk and Cargill Ocean Transportation, two of the largest carrier companies, recently created the Poseidon Principles, which apply direct climate change considerations to ship financing decisions. And they get support from some big banks like ING and Crédit Agricole in France and Britain's Lloyd's. And they're starting to, the leadership companies are starting to make commitments to cut emissions. Maersk 60% before 2030. That's a pretty big chunk in the next 10 years. And with a goal, steering towards the goal of a zero carbon future by the middle of the century. Excuse me. And so that's what this is about. There's just a lot going on there in terms of not just the kind of fuel, but the kind of efficiency they have and how cargo sits in both. There's so many things you can do to improve the efficiency of ocean-going freighters. And for a long time, it wasn't a demand. It wasn't needed. But now it most certainly is.
And, when I was reading it, I'd love to show you my papers when I see you next week, but it's not only going to take like a heavy lift in terms of, creativity and innovation. I think unparalleled innovation. It's going to take billions of dollars, like billions, for some of the things yeah. that they're requiring. Is it too heavy a lift? Do you think some of those goals we can reach? I mean, it gave me a lot of hope, but it's like, how the heck are they going to get from here to there?
Well, shipping companies are obviously always investing in their fleets and new fleets and if new efficient ways, you know, to save fuel, which is obviously their biggest cost. You know, with all these things, you know, it's always an ecosystem, a village, if you will, that you need the fuel companies, the big companies that provide these fuels. You need the shippers, the companies that use these ships. So let's say IKEA or Nike or whoever it is that's, you know, Apple that's shipping things across oceans at quantity to start to demand this. One of the challenges is that as big as Apple is, and it's one of the biggest companies in the world, and as many iPhones, Macs, and everything else that they ship, it's still only a teeny tiny fraction of the cargo that's on any given ship. So right. No one company can really drive this. And you can tell the shipping companies that you want them to use cleaner fuel or any number of other things, but they'll say, well, there's no supply and it's more expensive and who's going to pay for it? So yeah, it is this complicated, but it's true with every one of these things we're talking about. There's money that's needed, there's demand and carrots and sticks. There's also regulatory initiatives. There's also commitments, voluntary commitments by the world. The airlines now are making commitments to reduce their carbon emissions around the world. That we need similar things from the shipping industry.
And I think that's really going to happen. And, you know, the next one, which is companies warm to nature-based solutions, you could see the paperwork. I have the proof. I put this is one of my favorite, and I didn't know that it was one that you authored because you have quite a vast array of authors. But warming to nature-based solutions, there was so much that gave me hope about that. So talk about what that sustainable trend is.
Well, we all know about trees and planting trees, and is one of the ways to mitigate the greenhouse gas emissions that are going up into the atmosphere and causing climate change. But there's a lot more going on there in both, not just with trees, but also with other initiatives to harness land and nature's services, the things that nature does every day, if we let it. To mitigate climate change. And so this is something, all of these trends were written, let's say 2 to 3 months ago, and there's developments on all of them, including recently at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, they committed to a trillion trees. Yes, trillion with a T-R-I-L-L-I-O-N. And I can't remember the time horizon for that. But that's obviously, I don't know whether that's even possible, whether there's enough land to do that. And, you know, and there's problems with that too, because not all these trees, in fact, most of the trees don't survive long enough to do their duty. But even if it's a 95% failure rate, that's still 50 billion new trees. It's still a big number. And I'm guessing they accounted for that. So, there's this growing understanding, I think this is the bigger picture, that nature is critical to economies. And there's a group called Business for Nature that's been formed as a consortium from organizations like the World Business Council for Sustainable Development and the World Economic Forum and the We Mean Business Coalition and the International Chamber of Commerce and other groups that are looking at this. And this issue is really coming to a head as, you know, we look at the role of agriculture and how it both causes climate change and can be a solution to it if it's done right. And land use in general, and how that relates to biodiversity, the abundant critters that we have on this planet that are not just nice to do, but these critters all play critical roles in the food chain that leads to climate change in terms of the things that they do and the things they eat, that, you know, the things that they poop, the things, you know, become fertilizer. I mean, they're critical parts of this. So we're going to see something, I think, later this year in October in Kunming, China. There's going to be a UN biodiversity summit. They're sort of talking about it as the Paris for biodiversity. In other words, that COP21 back in 2015, which was where the Paris Agreement was formed, that there's going to be some significant outcomes of that. And a lot of this is no longer about the birds and the trees. It's about business prosperity. Pure and simple.
And the economic impact, the social benefits, and what I loved about this report is that there seems to me to be integrated approach among many of the players. It's not just a one-off, let's go plant trees. There are other applications and looking at the built environment and water, rainwater harvesting and all of those things that are the thing that why I got excited about it is because in many cases, it doesn't require billions of dollars. And the caution I would do, I'm reading Jeff Nesbitt's book, is very exciting. This is the way the world ends. And he talks about the green wall and what people have to be aware of in those positions. You're right. It's not just about planting trees. There's whole ecosystems that can be put in place around them to greater ensure their success. And I think that's really noteworthy. And the impact can be immeasurable.
And it can also be measured.
And that's one of the goals. The other good part of it.
As these nature-based solutions are being rolled into nationally determined contributions as part of each country in the world, except for maybe the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Agreed to do as part of the 2015 Paris Agreement. Some of this will include nature-based solutions. And particularly in developing economies. So, yeah, let's move on to the next one.
And it's also just my final comment. There's a lot of things going on at the local level in spite of the federal level and lack of leadership there. Okay, number three, unreal this one. Last mile transportation, inches closest to home. How many trucks do you have in your neighborhood on any given day? So let's talk about that one.
Yeah, well, we're starting to reach what, some of us call peak delivery. When you think of all the trucks that are, coming around once, twice, not just UPS and FedEx anymore, Amazon and any number of grocers or food companies and on and on, and delivering box goods or meals or whatever it is. And, there's a lot of congestion, a lot of pollution. And the question is, well, how do we deal with that? I mean, because it's undoing some of the savings that have been touted about e-commerce in terms of having to drive to the store and so on. And we haven't even gotten to the cardboard boxes yet. And so a number of firms are starting to use electric delivery vans, including e-cargo bikes, scooters. Obviously, there'll be someday, drones and things that are delivering things on our doorstep. But the big companies like UPS, which ordered 950 electric vans, and FedEx is planning on adding 1,000 electric delivery vehicles itself. So this is how we're starting to realize that, again, it's a technology born of a problem, the problem being too many vehicles, too much pollution from them. So how do we clean that up? In Europe, not surprisingly, cities like London, Berlin, Madrid, and Amsterdam, they're establishing fossil fuel-free zones or emissions-free zones in city centers in an attempt to try and cut air pollution and cut traffic and noise and greenhouse gases. And so these green zones, as they're sometimes called, is another thing that's pushing these companies to come up with because sometimes electric vehicles are exempted from these. How do you get the packages to all the people who are ordering stuff? And it's more and more every year. That's a big challenge.
Big challenge and ever growing. I mean, it's one of the, to me, in sectors that are doing better and making progress, this is one of the fastest growing big bad wolves because it's ridiculous. And when you think about cities where the air can't circulate and people start not being able to breathe, it's going to be front and center. Like New York City, it's like a joke. I try to walk there anytime I'm there. So it's a big one too. Who do we watch? Who are the big dogs to watch? I thought that was very interesting.
UPS and FedEx and Amazon, which obviously is one of the biggest entrants now into this. And then a lot of startups that are creating these vehicles, pedicabs, e-cargo bikes, small electric neighborhood vehicles and other things. So a lot of innovation still to come there.
Okay, let's go on to the next one.
Carbon markets, get real on removal.
Oh my God, I love that title.
So much we talk about around greenhouse gases is how do we emit less of it or none of it at all? And that's a beautiful thing. We definitely need to turn off the tap of those emissions. But we also really can't solve the climate crisis without removing what's already up there. And there's, as we know, a lot, that parts per million, I think we're up to like 413 parts per million, which is way above the 350 or so that people were striving for early on. And so there's a actually becoming a business now. We do a conference, Verge Carbon, as part of our bigger Verge conference every October in Silicon Valley. There's starting to be business opportunities here in terms of bringing the carbon back down to Earth and sequestering it, or in things like cement, or even using it to create polymers to make building materials, but and concrete and asphalt that it can go into. But also, you know, where is there a market, you know, through farming and tree planting, as we were talking about, these other nature-based solutions, that how does that become a business and profitable? And they're starting to see the contours of that around, you know, prices on carbon in some countries. And what's really astonishing, Dina, is that how much the word, you know, carbon positive, although it's also called carbon negative, but in either case, it's a company that's removing more carbon than they're emitting. Those kinds of commitments that are being made, both Microsoft and Starbucks made commitments around that just this month. And more are starting to talk about how not just do we stop the bad stuff, but how do we become regenerative? How do we become positive? And what's the business opportunity there? And it's still emerging, but there's really some interesting things taking place there. Again, with sort of traditional sequestration, just pumping it into the ground, but also using it to enhance the soil and make soil more climate resistant, as well as making it more productive for crops, and then turning it into products, like I said, concrete and alternatives to steel and aluminum.
And when you watch a big dog like Shell, who is a significant buyer, committing something like $300 million on forestry project and other nature-based solutions, you know, businessmen and women take note. It's if they're getting skin in the game, we should be watching, and it's very encouraging to me also. Okay, number five, corporate climate reporting gets physical. Yeah. I love that title too.
Sounds like an Olivia Newton-John song back from the day.
Let's do it.
So there's a growing concern and interest. I mean, the whole issue of ESG, environmental, social, and governance reporting by companies has just shot up big time in the last year. We do a Greenfin Summit at our Phoenix event, and it's coming up in called GreenBiz 20. And we're going to be doing a whole day on sort of this whole thing. And one part of it is that investors are now getting increasingly concerned about what's the risk of climate change to the physical facilities, the buildings and pipelines and other infrastructure and the facilities that companies use to do business around the world. Because it's not just corporate headquarters in California, New York, or Texas, or wherever it is. It's that for the entire supply chain. A number of years ago, there was a flood in Thailand that basically wiped out a good chunk of the market for production of disk drives globally for the better part of a year because of flooding. And there wasn't a lot of redundancy or backup or alternative sources for these things. And so in a world where we're going to see more floods and droughts and fires and whatnot, you know, how do first of all, who's at risk? Investors want to know, because it's going to play into their stock valuation and other things. And by the way, what are they doing about those risks? What are they doing about things in harm's way? Are they trying to harden the targets through any number of means? Are they trying to find alternative or redundant sources for supply chain? If you're an investor in a big company, and you know, or big institutional investors like BlackRock and State Street and
right.
CalPERS and others are, you know, have vested interest in all this. You want to know that the physical facilities are going to be taken care of, or at least not going to cause any disruptions as climate becomes a bigger and bigger factor.
And to me, this goal, this trend is getting to the heart of the true economic impact of climate change, the weather. Mostly the weather, and people don't understand. It makes banks vulnerable, because if they gave a loan on a big new 10-story building and it goes down in a tsunami, it threatens the whole financial infrastructure if we don't start paying attention. And you look at Fukushima, we're still paying for that. Our health is, but they're still paying for that. That was like 10 years ago, 12 years ago. I don't know, but it's the most encouraging thing to me is that it's really going to get people's attention when you start coming up with numbers that are all measured in the same way, and that they anticipate a growing number of legal actions against companies and their directors. You know, as the severity continues, they want people to be responsible. And if they're not, they're going to fine them or sue them or something's going to happen. Yeah. Okay. Let's go on to
number... And obviously the credit rating agencies and the insurance companies are clearly concerned about this. And so, yeah, lots more to come.
And most people don't talk about it. It's not, they don't go deeper into the ripple effect on and on and on. Next one. Yeah. So exciting.
So we're halfway through. So let's keep
We're going to do it. Corporate climate reporting gets physical.
No, we just did that one. So it's now employee activism on sustainability.
Marches on.
Yeah. So, you know, employees are acting up, stepping up, speaking up, standing up, raising their arm, raising their fist, raising trouble in some cases. I think a lot of people know about the 1,700 Amazon employees that pledged to walk out of work for the Global Climate March last September. And increasingly, there's been activists, not just at Amazon, but growing other companies within the ranks of employees who are saying, stop, let's take a breath here and look at what we're doing. I know we've made commitments and things, but we need to be moving further faster. And in some cases, we need to stop doing some things altogether. And this is different than having Greenpeace or the Sierra Club knocking on your door or hanging, you know, banners from your building. This is your employee base that's concerned. It goes not just to your existing employees who may not want to work there anymore, but also how do you attract the talent from particularly the younger generation that's growing up saying our climate is in trouble. And the generation a little bit older than Greta Thunberg, but certainly looking out because she's 17 and she'll. You know, her compatriots will be in the market in about 5 years for job markets. This is becoming a challenge for some companies. I think we'll see this at financial institutions. We'll see this at tech companies. And who knows where it's going. But that's a trend that's just getting going. And I think we're going to see a lot more actions on the part of employees in terms of speaking up against their employers on these topics.
And the other encouraging thing in this, and I always look for hope in anything I read, because on any given day, sometimes I have to dig a little deeper, but it really isn't just employees. There are some forward-thinking, I would call them highly evolved CEO activism, getting together and talking about the impact they can have on legislation and Congress, because corporations have juice when it comes to policy, and we certainly need some policies quickly, not rolling back things like the... Clean Water Act, which I'm throwing that in, but we'll move right along here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, actually, let me say one more thing about that, Gina, because I think one of the things employees are doing is they're taking a page from the LGBT handbook where we saw a few years ago, companies or employees saying, we don't want to go to North Carolina because of some of the policies and regulations and laws that they've enacted relating to discrimination around bathrooms and other topics. And companies said, okay, we're going to cancel or remove our meeting. I think there was an NCAA championship game or something that got moved from Charlotte to another state. And so that was as a result of employees rising up, not CEOs saying, we must take a stand. But you're right, there will be more CEOs. And I think what's happening is that some of the CEOs that do step up on this will be because their employees are telling them they have to.
Are demanding it. Sometimes it's not for the greater good. And to me, what's been okay in the past is small steps, incremental changes. And I think the pace is going to be accelerated in some cases where employees better like get ready for maybe just a little bit of a bigger leap. Okay, Joel, commercial buildings going all electric. I'm obsessed these days with the built environment. So talk about what that's going to look like.
Well, this is part of a trend that's really about what people often call the electrification of everything. How do we make everything from cars and airplanes and even ships and some other things electric. And thanks to the continued and will continue for a long time, improvements in battery storage and other things, that's becoming more and more possible. Some of you who are under 30 or 40 will forget the fact that having laptops that could hold a charge for more than a few minutes is a relatively new phenomenon. You had to have them plugged in, and the ability to have them operate for hours now on batteries is directly a result of not only the technology improving, but also getting smaller and smaller to fit inside a phone or a laptop. And so, buildings, so the goal is, how do we electrify everything and then make that electricity green, renewable energy? And so that's now moving to the building stock, and there's a number of cities, particularly in California, about 40 cities, I believe, in California, including San Francisco and San Jose, that have said no new commercial buildings that use natural gas as a heating fuel, that it has to be electric. And that's there's policies coming out, and of course there's the falling cost of renewables, which is making that possible. There's a new generation of electric appliances that are more efficient and maybe replicate the gas experience in the case of stoves, but in the case of a heating or cooling ventilation, HVAC system, you know, we don't really have to replicate anything except the fact that it just needs to heat and cool and ventilate. And so as we see natural gas, which we once saw as a bridge fuel, now becoming a fairly large source of greenhouse gas emissions as fracking boom and the leakage that goes from that, and that there's methane, it's not just the carbon dioxide, which is what comes out of our tailpipes, but it's methane, which is an even more potent gas, much higher levels than originally thought, coming when you either mine or burn natural gas. So yeah, that's I think we're going to be seeing Adobe broke ground and its North Tower last year for will be the first all electric office building in Silicon Valley. This is, you know, these buildings really take forever, you know, to plan and build, and then they have a, you know, maybe a 30 or 50 year life. So this is a long-term trend, but we're seeing more and more of that every year.
And it's another one that's really complicated that has a lot that I just want to comment on, because there's rewriting business codes, which in our city, you could grow old waiting for codes to change. And I'm not kidding, and I'm not slamming Tucson, yeah, but they're not on the cutting edge of the city anyway. The county's much better. And then there's a whole idea of, you know, to me, the greenest building is the one that's already there. So there's a issue of retrofitting and having the appropriate and qualified people on the commercial side for retrofits. But the exciting thing to me is, what an opportunity for architects to reimagine their world and to reconceptualize things. That's part of what excites me about this trend, and we'll be watching. Okay, next one. Circularity becomes measurable. Wow, this is this. Were you doing the happy dance over this one? Because it's a big one.
Well, I try to do the happy dance on all of them. They're all pretty interesting, as you said. So we've been talking about this thing called a circular economy, and it's just an amazing amount of action around that, and energy and initiative around creating that. But you know, how do we measure it? How do we know that we're actually making progress? How do we know that something is circular? And so we're getting a lot more in terms of definitions and standards and frameworks and indicators. The World Business Council for Sustainable Development this month released something called the Circular Transition and Indicators, a framework which helps companies assess its operations and from design to procurement to new business models and resource recovery in terms of creating products and services and business models that keep those molecules in play, that keep the materials flowing after they've outlived their initial life, that there's a new life for them. And there are about 20 big companies that helped create this this circular transition indicator: Philips and Suez and Whirlpool and Royal DSM, which is a European material science company. And so that's just one. We're seeing a lot more coming out of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation in the UK in terms of how do you create metrics for assessing progress. And as we operationalize circularity and it gets to scale, this is going to be a really important part of understanding what we're called stocks and flows. How do you track how well we're doing?
And I think for the average person on the street, this is a really tough one to get your head around because it requires so much change, you know, at the systems level, at the business level, at the product level. And I just want to read two sentences because I think this is what people should hone in on. At all levels, systems, business, and product, the development of specific and actionable metrics is a key accelerator for circularity at scale that allows data-driven decisions to be made, tracked, and celebrated. Of course, the operative word is actionable. And again, it's going to require more than just closing the loop on what you're making. There's a lot of moving parts to this. Would you agree with that? It's a much deeper cut.
Well, there's lots of moving parts, as I said earlier, for all of these things. And yeah, this
true.
Is something where, you know, companies have to come together. And to your earlier point, you know, that almost all of these are things that consumers don't need to think about or know about as they are in the marketplace. I mean, they're not going to be thinking about the kind of ship or fuel that brought their product from
they're
Asia.
Not.
They're not going to be thinking about the nature-based solutions that companies might be using to offset their emissions, make their factories less vulnerable to climate change. They may not even be thinking about the cool electric vehicle that delivered that widget to their doorstep. With less congestion and pollution. And so many of these things are happening behind the scenes. And I think that's what we cover day in and day out at GreenBiz, sort of what's going on within the economy and business and value chains, or maybe it's now value loops. And so I think that's what's interesting about all these is that, and that's why, you know, to people who are not in business, you know, to the extent that they're willing to geek out on some of this stuff, it's pretty hopeful.
And you set you set the next one up like it's perfect. If you want to finish that statement, but like this is the next one that everybody cares about. Everybody in my circle of friends and is talking about. So nutrient, I love it. Nutrient diversity goes beyond meatless meat. Talk to us about that. It's a biggie.
This is a contradiction of what I was just saying, and this is the one that probably does affect people in the store. But yeah, we now are getting comfortable with the notion of beefless beef. But how about pigless pork or chickenless chicken or eggless eggs?
I just
couldn't
believe it when I read that. It's like, ew.
All that's in the works right now, and we're going to be seeing some of it even this year, at least you know, starting to, you know, these things come out, they tiptoe into the marketplace. They don't come with a tsunami. And so, it's Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat and Memphis Meats and these other companies are starting to ramp up and go public and get to scale. Behind that is a whole generation. And by the way, don't really talk about it in this trend, but I think it's important to point out that, you know, there's questions about the nutritional value of some of these things, the caloric value of the number of calories in a Impossible Burger, and not to pick that one out, but all of the others can be as much or more than in a traditional burger, or the amount of sodium for those people who are conscious and sensitive to that. And so, this is hardly a perfect solution yet, but it's only Gen 1, or maybe we're Gen 1.2 or 3 at this point of these things, and they will be evolving, but we're going to be seeing more and more and more and more of these kinds of alternatives. And of course, the sustainability implications of that relative to the amount of water and energy that it takes to produce meat from animals and the amount of emissions that go into the atmosphere, not just greenhouse gas emissions, but water pollution and other air pollutants are significant. And as we ramp these things up, there's the potential to make a significant dent in that, particularly as a billion or 2 billion or 3 billion people who are knocking on the door of the middle class around the world start to get an appetite for things like meat that they necessarily didn't have before.
Yeah, Joel, how about this one? I mean, I am a picky eater. Like, I don't even like mushrooms. So I think some of this is going to be challenging for me. But one of the lines that I underlined in red, there is going to be coming to a grocery store near you, a plant-based shrimp that's made from algae and other ingredients. And they have shrimp in quotes. And it should be in the grocery stores this year. I mean, I read that. I was like, oh my goodness, cannot wait for that. So I just had to throw that in. But to your point,
yeah,
it is the one that is most relatable for the public and for me being in that category. And it answers a problem of starvation and all of crops decimation and the impact of climate change. I saw this as a big hopeful trend of how we're going to feed all the people that are going to be on the planet and indeed some that are already here. Another thing that I think we should point out, you know, you always want to say, what are the big dogs doing? I'm always watching, what are the big dogs doing? And you've got Tyson and Nestle and Unilever, they're all getting on the train. I mean, it's like, if they're on it, we're going to see big changes faster.
And they're going to end up the ones who are buying Memphis Meats and Impossible Foods and the other. Some of those will go be standalone companies. A lot of them will get acquired. Some of them, of course, will go away. That's how we've seen with so many other parts of the clean economy, is that the entrepreneurs come in and then the natural foods in particular, you know, you see Kellogg's and General Mills and Coca-Cola and Pepsi own a lot of the brands like Ben & Jerry's and Stonyfield Farm and Cascadia Farms and Annie's and Homegrown, Homemade, and things that started off as individual companies and are now brands within a larger, because those big companies can scale. They have the power, the distribution, the brand knowledge, the money to take these things from a niche to a 0.5% or 1% or 2% of the market and get it up to 10% or 20% or 30% market penetration. And that's where we really start to make the difference that needs to be made.
And when you're talking about places like Burger King, I mean, it's in Burger King's all over here. So that's when it goes mainstream. And a lot of my friends, almost all my friends, are eating less meat, myself included, our family included. But I want a good burger and fries sometimes. I have to put on a disguise in Tucson so that nobody sees Mrs. Green going to a fast food place. I don't go very often, but sometimes I just want a burger and fries. And Kelly, our show producer, got a burger at Burger King. And I have to say, I could eat it. I could eat it. So that's a big, and I am the pilly eater. So it's going
to
be.
And you may find that your aversion to mushrooms is something that's not allergic. You won't even know there. There's going to be, you know, there's already blended meats where they've got part mushrooms used along with traditional meat. You may be surprised.
I will. And when you see things like the Grammy, it wasn't the Grammys, it was before that, they fed a vegan meal, was a meatless meal. And that made a lot of the news stations. It's like, yeah, this is really coming. I don't think they had Impossible Burgers, but I was not invited. So I didn't, it was on a need to know basis. I didn't need to know. Okay, let's give some time to this last one, because of all the ones that were, this is a challenging one for me to absorb, understand, and articulate. The bots are coming. The bots are coming. So tell us what's going to happen when the bots come.
Yeah, well, this goes back to the original, what we were talking about a few minutes ago, about some of these things are so geeky and behind the scenes that it's not that interesting to people who aren't really in the business of sustainability. And this is, companies are reporting more and more information, but that's partly because investors, in particular, as I said earlier, the big mainstream investors are asking and demanding more and more from the companies that they invest in, which is pretty much every public company. And they're also, companies can be slow to respond or may not respond exactly the right way, or may not respond in a way that can compare apples to apples. But it's, so they're using bots and other things that crawl around the web, that creepy things that happen all the time. That's how Google decides, you know, its rankings and knows what's out there in the first place. It's got these spiders and other bots and things that are crawling around looking for things and cataloging them. bots are now starting to be used by ratings and rankings organizations to look at even small, minor wording changes from one year to the next in corporate sustainability reports that signal some potentially significant changes. Because companies, you know, they often talk about sustainability in more legalistic terms because there's risk involved. They don't want to spook investors, and they may talk about it a little bit, you know, obtuse, obscure way. And they may change it slightly based on growing concerns without necessarily trumpeting that. Well, a bot can easily, you know, find those differences and weigh them, at least flag them, so that an analyst go to that company and say, how come you changed this from that to this year? And so the point of that, and our a good chunk of our audience for this report are corporate sustainability professionals inside big companies, and many of whom do reporting, I think just need to be aware of what's out there and the fact that sustainability data is becoming, because of that, much more up to date and not a year or two behind. And in some cases, they're able to actually have data, sustainability data, as fresh and current as financial data, which is a big, big change.
And whoever wrote this had a sense of humor, okay? Because it said that, you know, sustainability professionals have fretted about whether anybody reads their reports. And now it sure. said it's not going to be the who, but it's going to be the whats. The bots are going to be reading those reports and using them. And I just, yeah. you know what, I was sitting there, I'm saying, so what is the impact on my life? Well, the impact on Mrs. Green's world, which is about SEO and being picked up and having people find us, the more data that's out there, the better we can do at being discovered because of great interviews that we have every week. I mean, it's like it's a big crowded space. And this will help, I hope, at you know, down the road, bring significant information to us that will help.
Yeah, well, I hope that's the case.
Okay, so we are going to do this. That's it. So I have just two questions, and we might even get off a little earlier. I could keep you on for 2 hours, you know that, but how do you pick the top 10? What makes it and what doesn't? Well, like you said, there's 130 or 400 or 600. There's more than that.
No.
Who decides what makes the cut?
Well, the Green Biz editors, we do that every year. We're always looking out, and me in particular, one part of my job here at Green Biz for these days is looking around corners to see what's coming. And, you know, the fact that we started a circular economy conference last year was part of that. The fact that we started also last year this Green Finance Summit that did so well, and we're doubling the size of it this year. Is partly a result of that. And you know, as you know, we're publishing stories every business day. And if you see our newsletter or frequent our site. So we're looking at these things, and you know, it doesn't, when you're up to your neck in this stuff, you often, you know, hopefully you can step back some time and see trends. But yeah, I mean, there's trends we didn't include, we could have included. So it's always a combination of art and science. But I've already got two or three trends that I want to put in the 2021 report. So I just see, and it'll change. We may end up with 20, and then we winnow it down to the 10 that we want to feature. The other thing, you know, frankly, is that, you know, we don't want to repeat the same trends every year. So
right.
There's always the circular economy is coming. And, you know, you can only beat some of those drums, even if there's some new development. And so have to take a fresh tack on some of these things every year and not, you know, not repeat them every year or two or three. So it's, you know, it's trends are not a science, so there's definitely some expertise involved.
And the other part of it is that it's never been more exciting. Like, you've been doing this a lot longer than I have, but we're in our 11th year and things are accelerating. Positive changes, more awareness, corporate leadership, employee voices. I mean, that's all new information that gives me hope, because some days it's hard to have hope in this business, as I'm sure you know. You seem to be always pretty hopeful, but I'm not around you all the time.
Yeah, well, you see the public me, and, you know, I have my days for sure.
Oh,
but no, you're right. For those of us in sustainability, there's never been a time that's more exciting or engaging or terrifying. And I think that, you know, we all in sustainability, and I know this is true for you too, we all live with that duality every day. It's like, oh my God, how cool is this? Oh, this is so exciting. Oh, I'm so glad this is finally being addressed. Like, who'd have thunk that you'd be seeing A, B, and C? At the same time, we're seeing all these horrible headlines and trend reports from the IPCC and from, you know, EPA even, and from lots of environmental groups about, and not to mention just the news about what's happening in Antarctica or the Amazon or Australia, and that's just the letter A. You know, there's just so much happening. And so, yeah, one of the challenges for sustainability professionals is how do you stay hopeful and also realize that there we need to be stepping up and moving much faster than we are. That's really, I think, the interesting and tension and dynamic and, as I said, duality that we all live with every day.
And when you read about things that will measurably draw down carbon, which is so important, as important any day of you know, reducing emissions, drawing down is so important. And then for me, when I read about solutions that are going to be able to feed the people that are already starving, the millions more that are on track to starve because of the impacts of climate change, it gives me hope from the very human side of things. It's like, yeah, don't give up, Murph. There's more coming and it's good. And it can happen quickly, because that's what I worry about. Is it going to happen fast enough? Or did we get on the bus quickly enough? And I use all these metaphors. Has the train left the station? And I can't think that. I can't do what I do and think that. We have to keep putting other things on the train. Is there one that gives you the most hope?
Oh, wow. There's a lot. I mean, the youth movement gives me a lot of hope.
Yes.
That maybe we're finally seeing a generation growing up saying, we can't just pussyfoot around this. This is we have to take this on head first and if you don't do it, we're going to do it and we're going to hold you accountable. But that's, you know, that's not necessarily, that's, I think, starting to have an impact, but it's sort of undergirding a lot of these changes. You know, I just, this, it's more, it's no silver bullet, as you know, it's a lot of silver buckshot.
Right.
And that's really what gets me going every day, is you never know what to expect. You never know what new company is going to make some bold and audacious commitment. You never know what new technology is all of a sudden going to come out of the blue and start to get to scale quickly. You know, we didn't see the alternative meat thing happening 2 or 3 years ago, at least at the way that it's turned out. And so that's what's always fun and interesting and engaging.
And for the report, there's nuggets. There are nuggets, some a few, some many, in every one of them that lead to an integrated, systemic, hopeful, people talking to each other approach. It's not just a one-off. So it gave me a lot of hope. And I'm going to thank you and close out with a few last words from me. And it's an ask. It's, we have such a broader base these days of wonderful listeners. So here's my ask. Read the report. There's going to be a link on the bottom of this podcast page directing you to how to get it. And don't just read it. Share it with people. If you're a business person, if you're a mom, if you're a concerned parent, it's for you. It's written in English, not science, so that you can understand it. And I really applaud that, because in order to be able to grasp it, you have to be able to understand it. And it really is for anyone who cares about the clear and ever-present danger of climate change. And as I said, then share it. We need things to give us hope, to guide us when it comes to good businesses. It tells me where I want to shop. And if it were up to me, if I ran the zoo, the Big Green Zoo, I'd make it required reading for high school and college students. I'm going to get my grandson to read it, all of them. Mm. People ask me all the time if there's hope or if I have hope when it comes to the reality of climate change, all the time. They say, Gina, do you have any hope? And this report got my hopes up again in a very concentrated way. And sometimes, as I said, that's not easy for me. So thank you, Joel McCower, for being an inspirational leader, for showing up in my life. You have left a forever footprint. And where you lead, you can be sure I'm going to be one of the ones following. And to all of our wonderful listeners, thank you, because without you, there would be no us. So thank you, Joel, and I will see you next week and hopefully catch you to get our annual selfie.
I look forward to that, Gina, and thank you so much for your support and your kind words.